Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here with us again today. Sunday morning wake-up call. Today, we are going to explore some unsolved mysteries in the universe. We've got Allison Costa here with us. She's a visiting scholar, UVA's Department of Astronomy, and an assistant scientist at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory here in Charlottesville. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us and for helping us learn about the unsolved mysteries in the universe. Are you going to solve any for us today?
No, I will probably just keep opening the box of questions over and over again, unfortunately.
Well, maybe someone who we entice into doing more research will actually do some of the solving for us all. So one of the first things, let me back up for a second. You have done a class several times on this topic at UVA, correct?
Yes, I taught it in the spring of 2019 and then the spring of 2020, which then transitioned to being online and was a totally different experience.
Well, I'm not surprised. I think many teachers of all levels would say that teaching online is quite different, but what makes you say that?
It's really hard to talk to someone when you can't see their face. And when you have a bunch of students that you don't see their faces, it's really hard to judge body language. And I don't know, part of teaching from my perspective is kind of a comedy role, and that's really hard to do when you can't be in front of them.
I would agree that that body language is an important part of conversation. So, but let's get into the unsolved mysteries of the universe for today's conversation with Allison Costa from the National Radio Astronomy Observatory and from UVA's Department of Astronomy. Origin of the universe. I think many people, if you asked, I would have only expected two answers on the origin of the universe: the Big Bang theory or creation by God. But yeah, a little research tells me that there are more theories than that.
So it's really hard to talk about the origin of the universe because we don't have a lot of ways to test what we think about. And so, as you said, the two options that come up the most, especially like when I'm having these conversations with students, is it's either some creation from an omnipotent being, or we have the Big Bang theory, which I will immediately get on my high horse and say that the Big Bang theory is actually not a story about the origin of the universe. It's actually the story about the change in our universe. And it doesn't say much of anything about how the universe started. And so then you have to go to completely other different sources to even start talking about that question.
So can you tell us what some of the options and theories are for the origin of the universe?
Yeah. So they're a wide range and they're all very interesting. And I will preface this by saying that this is in the realm of like big feelings for a lot of cosmologists. And those are people who, you know, study the universe. When you get to these type of questions, you can easily start treading on toes. So I will say that like I'm not an expert and I don't do research in these areas. So I kind of get to just enjoy them as they are. But so with that being said, when people talk about the origin of the universe. They range from being this idea of it's just like this quantum mechanical soup, which is basically an idea of you can think of like a fabric of basic particles that are fluctuating randomly, and one of them fluctuates in a particular way, and that bubbles up into a universe. And so that's kind of a quantum mechanical vision of what an origin of the universe might look like. Some people talk about how maybe inside of black holes, that's where universes can go or where they are. And if you could go through a black hole and survive, you might find yourself in a different universe. So they might act both as like wormholes or birthplaces of new universes. There's also the idea that we know the universe to be expanding. We've known that since the mid-90s. And so right now it's accelerating and it's expansion. Well, I'm sorry. We've known that for a while since Edwin Hubble and Einstein, but we now know it's accelerating in its expansion since the 90s. But the idea is that it doesn't have to keep doing that. It could like reverse course and come crashing back into itself. And so maybe when it comes crashing back into itself, the next step after that, it's going to bounce back and become a big universe again. And this is the cyclic universe idea, that it just gets big and then it gets small and it restarts and does this kind of bounce scenario. And so those are the ones that we talk about in the class that I teach. They all have very particular aspects, and you know what we require of them eventually is that these ideas make predictions that we can test, and that's the hard part and why we don't really know what the origin is, because a lot of these ideas can't be tested yet.
In preparation for the show with you today, Unsolved Mysteries in the Universe, I read about the black hole origin theory. Can you talk about that?
So this is the idea that you have, like I said, if you have a black hole, and if you could go through the inside, on the other side, there might be another universe. Or maybe at the beginning, everything was black holes, and that's we're living inside of one. Essentially, our universe would be inside of a black hole. But the next question I think would be, where did the black holes come from? So that's kind of that's always the next question. You can always ask, but where did that come from? And so that's always the chicken and egg situation you have going on when you talk about the origin of the universe. I don't know more particulars about the black hole origin theory beyond kind of that idea, though.
How does one theory get more noticed than another?
That's a good question. So I think a multitude of ways. Some people write books. There are a number of kind of like trade back or you know, just books you would find at your local bookstore that people like physicists and astronomers have written, and many of them do a wonderful job of describing what they think. And those books get popular, and so their ideas are really, you know, propagating out into the public sphere in an easy way. This also happens, you know, with like PBS specials. You will commonly find astronomers or string theorists on PBS specials talking about what they think the universe is doing. And that's an easy mode to get these ideas out. If you go read like the actual like science papers that we publish in academic journals, those get hairy really quickly. So I imagine most people are not reading those on a particular basis.
Again, we are talking about Unsolved Mysteries in the Universe with Allison Costa here with us today from the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, as well as UVA's Department of Astronomy. Allison, I want to talk about time. Can you discuss the concept of time and whether or not time always flows forward? And just take on that topic for me, please.
Sure. So time is one of these things that I think always surprises my students that we're going to talk about, because as a human, we have this, I think, pretty concrete idea of what time feels like. It's either something that marks changes in our life, or it's, you know, the clock always ticks forward for us. And then when you look at time from the perspective of what physics tells us, it starts to get really wonky very quickly. So one of my favorite topics to talk about in my class is quantum mechanics, which sounds super intimidating. And I certainly felt that way when I first started studying it and didn't appreciate it until I had to start teaching about it. But quantum mechanics tells us that the universe at some level probably has like randomness dictating a lot of these processes. And that's kind of a superficial way of putting it. But when you add that into the mix, it starts to affect how you perceive time. And quantum mechanics isn't the only one that does it. You also have to worry about like special relativity from Einstein and general relativity. Einstein had a lot to say about time. And in fact, he was one of the pioneers of quantum mechanics as well. And so he kind of gets both of those domains of like gravity and quantum mechanics. And what comes out of this is the idea that time is not this absolute thing that just marches forward in time without any regard to things. We each carry with us our own perception of time, our own clock. And this is mathematically described with Einstein's equations. And a basic example would be like GPS satellites are basically, they have clocks on them. They're very far from Earth, from the surface of Earth, and they're moving quite fast. And so there's two effects in that. There's a special relativity effect because they're moving quickly. So if you compare your clock on Earth to the GPS clock, they're not going to agree. It's also because it's far from the surface of Earth and thus further from gravity than we are. Once again, our clocks are not going to agree because of the distance from the center of the Earth. And that's an important effect when you're talking about, you know, GPS satellites, because if you don't account for those, then you're not going to be able to use your GPS satellite. But we know that the clocks are different, and neither one of them is actually the correct answer. So time feels to us like my clock is correct. And on Earth, we generally don't worry about these things because we're not really moving fast with respect to each other. And we're more or less all on the same distance from the center of the Earth. But when you go out into the universe, you do have to worry about those things, like if you're next to a black hole, for example. And neither of those clocks, if you make that comparison, has an absolute correctness to it. It's all about where you are and what speed you're moving at and how you're doing the comparison. So that's a fundamental shift in how we understand time in all places. And it's a very weird thing to have to be concerned about, especially if you're not on Earth anymore. So it's really kind of an attack on how we humans feel about time when we start talking about these issues, these physics problems when it comes to time.
But we only view time as moving forward. If we are marking our calendar or watching our clock, we only look at it in one direction. Is that how an astronomer views it? Can an astronomer or a physicist see time going backwards in any way?
So we generally do not see time going backwards. And the reason for that comes, well, I say reason lightly, but the idea is that there's a thermodynamical idea called entropy, which is the measure of how much order you have in a system. And because entropy must always increase, and so we go to less order in our system, that actually tells us the direction that time flows, and thus it flows forward. And that, so that's kind of the idea of why time flows in that direction. And we're not going to see it flow backwards. But quantum mechanics, which I was bringing up earlier, introduces this weirdness to this idea that I don't know that I fully can interweave in my mind. But there's a very awesome experiment called the double slit experiment from quantum mechanics. And it's like Big Brother, which is the delayed choice quantum eraser. And if you have time to go watch videos online, those two experiments in quantum mechanics, there's a lot of videos and they're really fun to watch. But what particularly the delayed choice quantum eraser is looking at is, on the surface level, can future actions actually change the past? And it comes down to how weird quantum mechanics is, but in a nutshell, maybe would be the answer. And that is such an interesting premise that something that hasn't happened yet by our books might actually be affecting a choice or a situation that is currently taking place.
You mentioned gravity and time, right? Gravity closer to Earth affects the clock differently than on the satellite further from Earth, correct?
Right.
So would a grand event of some sort that affects gravity upset time?
Yeah, absolutely. So the, like in a great example is, if you were some distance from a black hole and you had a clock with you and you had a friend with you and you synchronized your clocks and your friend went towards the black hole, as you were watching your friend, you would notice that their clock runs slower and slower and slower as they get closer and closer to the black hole. Because when you're close to the source of gravity, that can slow down time. So gravity can slow down the time. Now, your friend would look at their clock and think time is running just fine and would look at you, who is far from the black hole, and your friend would say, no, no, your clock is running too fast, too fast. And so when you have like major changes in gravity like that, or I mean, it doesn't even have to be a change. If you have gravity, you're going to be affecting the flow of time. You just need to be able to make that comparison. You have to have something to compare to. This is kind of where the statement of everything is relative gets thrown into the mix, because it's true. You don't know that your clock would be different until you compare it to someone else. And that is also difficult to a certain extent. You have to be in the same place to be able to do that.
Our guest today, Allison Costa. She's from the National Radio Astronomy Observatory and a visiting scholar at UVA's Department of Astronomy, as we're talking about some of the unsolved mysteries in the universe, which is a course that Allison teaches at UVA. Let's take a break. We'll come back, and there's plenty left to talk about. I've got a question about Einstein's equations. Thanks for being with us today. We're having a learned conversation with Allison Costa. Allison, you were talking about Einstein and his equations. One of the things that I did figure out and probably have forgotten from the past and had to go learn, Einstein's equations, everything is decided from the beginning. initial conditions of the cosmos determine what comes later, and surprises do not occur.
So Einstein, what I take from that is that initially when Einstein was writing down his equation that we use to calculate gravity, or essentially the gravitational or general relativity, he inserted a term that was the cosmological constant. And he did that because he thought the universe should be static and never changing. So in that sense, maybe I would agree with that statement that there were initial conditions and basically nothing changed because the universe has been the same as it always is. And Einstein thought that that should be true. And he artificially inserted this idea to make his equation basically balance out. And not so long after, Edwin Hubble, who the Hubble Space Telescope is named after, did an observation, and he saw that the universe was expanding, and that totally revolutionized this idea. And Einstein took Edwin Hubble's observations and went to his equation and said, ah, this is a mistake. And he actually called the cosmological constant his greatest blunder, because he had just inserted it, and he would have actually predicted that the universe was expanding had he not been biased towards this static universe. Now in like the 1978 or 9, I think, we actually resurrected the cosmological constant, not as a static term, but actually to make the universe expand even faster. And so now it's back in his equations, but for different reasons.
Do scientists believe that time will take the universe to an end?
The fate of the universe is arguably as murky as what its origin is to a certain extent, because we can't predict the future. We can only predict what we know is happening, or we can only use what we know now to help us understand what might happen, but it might change for reasons we don't yet understand. We currently understand the universe to be expanding and in an accelerating rate. If that stays the same, then the future of the universe is something that gets the fabric of time itself will get bigger, like more space will be added, which is such a bizarre concept, and I'm so sorry. But that's the idea of it, is that the space itself is expanding, and eventually things will start to move away from each other, and you will have stars won't be able to form anymore. So you won't have light in the universe, because stars are the things that make light for the most part. And if you don't have light, then you can't heat anything. And that's called the heat death, essentially, because there won't be any light, no energy in the universe to warm things up. And if you wait even more time, perhaps even the protons will decay, and then they'll just be black holes in the universe. But then the black holes will evaporate, and then there's just maybe nothing. And then you maybe have the perfect setting for bubbling out of nowhere again, or, you know, some type of new origin to a different universe. And so that's one option for the end, if we extrapolate what we currently understand. But maybe the universe changes course and it starts to recollapse on itself, and everything rushes back together and goes back to being something that looks like the beginning of our universe, in the sense that it's really dense and hot and everything's smushed incredibly like tightly together. Those are kind of extreme options that you have. And then my favorite one, perhaps just because it comes out of left field, is the quantum mechanical option, which says that, well, our universe could just pop out of existence any moment, and we'll never know if it can do that or not. But that's a little bit of an existential crisis waiting to happen.
I hope so. Allison Costa from National Radio Astronomy Observatory, as well as UVA's Department of Astronomy. We're talking about unsolved mysteries in the universe. Allison, what was the last great mystery that was actually solved?
I don't know. Solved is kind of a tough word, a heavy word to put before the science community, I think, because we're never quite satisfied with what answers we do find. And then it depends on who you ask. So I remember being in like my undergrad astronomy classes and my, grad school, and watching kind of the change in what's in the textbook as I went from being the student to teaching. And now I see a lot more discussion about the beginning of or the very early portions of our universe, because the theory of inflation, which describes this astronomical jump in size of our universe at the very beginning, is maybe more mainstream these days than it was when I was an undergrad, which isn't horribly long ago, but certainly long enough that the textbooks looked different. So that might be one of a discovery or a solution that people talk about as being extremely impactful to the community. I would think, and maybe in a less controversial way, the discovery of gravitational waves by the telescope LIGO, well, not a telescope, but the observing apparatus LIGO, the discovery of gravitational waves moving at the same speed of light. And that was just a few years ago. And that confirms further Einstein's theories of general and special relativity. And so that maybe probably would be one thing I would point to that's a solved thing, because we didn't know if gravitational waves, which are the ripples in basically the fabric of space and time, if they would travel at the same speed that light travels. They didn't have to, but they do. And that's super interesting that it happened that way.
So let me ask you about, I'm trying to pick a few here off my list. Let me ask you about dark energy. Can you explain dark energy?
So dark energy is arguably a placeholder for our future knowledge. We think that something must exist to oppose gravity, because if there was just gravity in the universe, and gravity is made from mass, and actually more than that, it's made from energy, it's even made from pressure. So you take all the stuff in the universe, and it's familiar stuff, it's stars, it's, you know, galaxies, and that all produces gravity. And so if you just had gravity, the universe would not be expanding. It would be pulling itself together, because gravity likes to pull things together. But because we don't see a collapsing universe, we know that something has to exist to be fueling this expansion. And that is right now what we call dark energy. Now, my limited non-expert knowledge of dark energy is that it is a property of the vacuum of space, which is a little misleading, because space actually is not empty. It is not a zero energy situation out there. If you just take any patch of space, even if you think you've grabbed nothing, you have still grabbed some quantum mechanical fields, or basically like a soup of murky particles that are blipping in and out of existence all the time, but doing it so quickly that it looks like it's empty. But if you actually measure the energy or the pressure produced by those little particles blipping in and out of existence, it's non-zero. And people have done this experiment to show that it's true. And so that might be what's providing the energy to repel gravity, or essentially anti-gravity.
As a non-scientist, when you say we measure it at non-zero,
yeah,
I get that concept for my thermometer, because it goes down to less than zero. Oh, it's -1 degrees out. How can I measure something in less than zero weight, or less than zero time, or less than zero mass to get non-zero?
So what I mean by non-zero is actually it can be a positive number. It wouldn't have to be negative. And by non-zero, I mean that if you think about it as a thermometer, and maybe let's pretend our thermometer is not allowed to go negative, but it has some bottom threshold. Like it basically has a limit at the bottom. And empty space isn't actually empty. It is filled with a little bit of things that just jitter around all the time. And so we can measure that jitter, and it's basically not zero. And that's the important part of it.
Allison Costa here with us today, UVA Department of Astronomy visiting scholar. Can dark matter actually meet regular matter? I don't know what the proper term would be.
So,
and what would happen?
Yeah, so there's, you know, astronomers and physicists are probably really bad at naming things for the most part. So we have this idea of dark energy, which is a placeholder for something we don't yet really understand. But dark matter, which is completely separate, we don't know what it is to a certain extent, but we do have a lot of experiments that show us that it's got to be there, and that it has certain properties, such as it doesn't interact with light beyond maybe manipulating light as in a gravitational way. It can cause gravity, like manipulations. It doesn't seem to interact with the matter that, like, you and I are used to beyond a gravitational sense. And so we know it has these properties, but we don't actually have a name for what it is yet either. And that has been an interesting change over the years as well, because I seem to remember when I first started learning about it, there were a host of options of what it could be. Oh, it's, you know, really small stars, it's black holes, and the list can go on. And that has changed over the years. But I think that because we haven't found an example of dark matter, we haven't captured it and been able to display it as like, yes, this is dark matter, the jury's still out on exactly what it is. But it does affect us to a certain extent, not here on Earth, really. There's not a lot of dark matter around Earth to make any appreciable difference to us. But it does dictate how stars orbit in our galaxy, for example.
Is that its role in our existence at this point? Its known role?
Yeah, pretty much. It's more of, I'd like to think of it as like a global effect, in the sense of it dictates how stars orbit and galaxies. It dictates how galaxies orbit around each other. And it is an important part of how, like, what's in our universe in terms of will gravity win or will anti-gravity win.
When you watch a movie with a superhero and a supervillain, do you end up rolling your eyes because you're like, that could never happen?
I'm really good at compartmentalizing. And so most of the time when I leave work, I really enjoy my work, but when I leave work, I try to appreciate, you know, kind of the extravagance that goes into our fiction. And I think life is more fun being able to enjoy that for the most part.
Allison Costa here with us today from the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, as well as UVA's Department of Astronomy, as we talk about unsolved mysteries in the universe. Allison, you have taught that class for a few years now, and you mentioned in the syllabus that you shared with me that the students would learn some cool astronomy that you can impress your friends with. So, I'm curious about one or two pieces that you can share here.
Yeah. So I mean, some of it we've already talked about, and perhaps this is lame, but like when I go to cool party, or when I go to parties to be cool, I always have to play a video called Dr. Quantum, which is the double slit experiment. And it's a quantum mechanical experiment. And it's this really Scooby-Doo style video, but it's a lot of fun. And I actually play that on the first day of the class that I teach, despite it being about quantum mechanics. The students love it and like really get engaged with this video because it is incredible what it tells you about like our world that you just don't learn about anywhere else. So I really like I said before, I really like quantum mechanics on kind of a surface level because I don't do that research. So it's fun to just kind of dip my toes into that water. But other really cool astronomy things is like you can go online to NASA's website and listen to the sound of the wind on Mars. And it's such a surreal experience to hear that because it sounds like wind and yet it's Mars. And so that's something that we do in this class is we explore what we do know from current scientific knowledge. And a lot of that is, you know, from satellites we've put out into our solar system and then also from images of the universe. And so we kind of step through these different levels of finding what's like really cool and talking about it. My last plug is for a type of, I'm going to use the word animal. I'm sure it's okay, but someone will probably call me on it. But it's called a tardigrade, or a tardigrade, and it's also known as a water bear, which is like a microscopic creature that can withstand the vacuum of space and extremely cold temperatures. And it might be an animal that can survive on an asteroid or a meteor and be transported between worlds. And so maybe they're aliens, or maybe they'll be someone else's aliens if they ever leave Earth.
All right. Well, you know, that leads us to our next break. And when we come back, let's talk about alien life for a little bit. So Allison Costa here with us as we talk about unsolved mysteries of the universe, and she brings her knowledge from the National Radio Astronomy Observatory and from UVA's Department of Astronomy. Be right back. And thank you for being here with us today. Sunday morning wake-up call. Not really helping to solve mysteries of the universe, but sharing unsolved mysteries in the universe and bringing them to light and discussion with Allison Costa, UVA's Department of Astronomy and the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. So Allison, before the break, you mentioned possible alien life. I'm not sure that the tardigrades, if that was the word, which I didn't write down, are the alien life that the listeners and myself might have as the imagery in our head from that word, that phrase. Can you mention what is the possibility of extraterrestrial life in the universe in the body type that we would expect in a human form? Two legs, upright.
It's a tricky question because you first have to say, what is life? What are your qualifications? If you want to go with what you just laid out, upright, two legs, humanoid form, like that is super specific. And it adds a lot of constraint onto what life would look like. Because arguably, I mean, we're the only life that looks like that that we know of. And there's tons of other life forms on this Earth that don't look anything like that. But if you were to agree on like more basic, just like maybe it has to eat, then I think generically most astronomers would agree that maybe pond scum is actually really prevalent or mildly prevalent. The fact is, though, is we just don't have enough data about what is necessary for life, because it doesn't have to look like us. It doesn't have to have oxygen, for that matter, if it didn't originate in a planet that had a lot of oxygen. And so we don't know what the probability of life is, really. There's this idea of the Drake equation, which is supposed to tabulate that probability, but we need more information, like how many habitable planets are there? What is a habitable planet? Does it have to be like Earth? Not necessarily. And we just don't have that information to fully flesh out our statistics of how probable is life. And the next part is that even if you say, yes, there's life, and maybe we say, yes, there's another intelligent life that has civilizations, the age of the universe is so, it's 13.25, you can kind of drop those decimals depending on, 13.5 billion years, and you can mess with the decimals if you want, depending on what data you're going with. In that time, maybe a whole nother civilization has risen and fallen and was there, but now is not. And we're here now. So can we even communicate with another civilization? That's a real issue. So maybe there's life like us out there, but are they around right now is a different question.
How many universes have been identified?
Just the one, ours. So we talk about the observable universe, which is our universe. People actually do talk about other universes, though, and that's a fascinating topic that's super controversial in these spheres. But it's the idea of the multiverse. And of course, people are probably familiar with multiverse ideas from Marvel, and it's not a bad guide to go off of, but it's this idea that there are other pocket, there's a lot of different types of multiverses, but there are other pocket universes out there that might look just like ours with small differences. And we have never found them, and it would be incredibly difficult to test for them. So I don't know that they will ever fully, that idea will ever be fully tested and fleshed out. But there actually are consequences to quantum mechanics that you can test, which might lead you to the consequences of multiverse theory. So it's not actually this radical, unspoken of thing. We talk about it at like national prestigious conferences now. So it is something we talk about.
Well, I asked that question based on, we go back to the beginning of the show, the origin of the universe, and the way I read black hole origin theory was that every black hole is a doorway to a new universe.
Yeah, that's the idea, that if you could go through the black hole, there's another universe there, and the one you came from hasn't disappeared. You will probably never be able to travel back to it, because you can't come out of a black hole, but you would be in a whole new universe, and it could look identical to the one you just came out of. Maybe it looks a little bit different, or maybe it looks radically different. Maybe it has different laws of physics that dictate it. So instead of gravity doing, you know, what it does in our universe, it does something slightly different. Those are all possibilities in the multiverse sphere.
How many black holes have been identified?
Many, and of all different sizes too. So we think that it's very common to find supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies. In fact, the Milky Way, our own galaxy, has a supermassive black hole at its center. And we have seen those black holes in many other places. And now we actually have a picture of two black holes from the Event Horizon Telescope. They put out their first one in 2019 in the spring. And they just actually this week, I think, released another picture of a black hole at the center of a galaxy. And so we think that they're really common, and they have a wide range of masses to them.
So if you are a believer in the black hole origin theory, that every black hole is a doorway to a new universe, and you've stated that there are multiple black holes in our universe, then there could be multiple other universes at the other ends of those black holes.
That is very true. If it's possible that you could go through and see that universe, then yeah, you might be able to access a whole series of universes through various black hole travel. I think, once again, the caveat is that you can never come back. So you have to be willing to make that one-way trip to a new universe.
So where would extraterrestrial life most likely be found in our universe? Would it need to be another, air quotes, Earth?
I don't think so. In fact, if I remember correctly, our own solar system is thought to perhaps house life on like the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. We've been really careful, and we, in the sense of, you know, space traveling humanity, or when we put out satellites, we've been really careful to not land our satellites or any of our missions on places where we think that there might be life. For example, the moon Enceladus. We think that maybe there might be life there. And so we've been very careful to not land any craft, so that when we eventually can land a sterile craft on there and if we find microbials, we can definitively say, like, yes, this is not from our contamination. This is life that did not originate on Earth, and it's separate. And so we don't actually have to travel potentially that far to find life in our solar system. Or life anywhere. And it, like I said, doesn't have to look like Earth at all. In fact, we have what we call extremophiles here on Earth that we could potentially find, like, on Io, which is a moon of Jupiter, and it's volcanic. We have bacteria here on Earth that thrive in volcanoes. So it's not weird to think that we might find a whole bunch of that similar bacteria on a moon that is, you know, volcanic.
Again, Allison Costa here with us today, talking about unsolved mysteries in the universe. Allison, to continue talking about alien life, extraterrestrial life, if we put back the image of the humanoid out there, what is the scientific world thinking about the U.S. government showing more and releasing more UFO photos? Is belief growing or waning?
I'm not a good spokesperson for the community, but I think that most people agree that more transparency is always a good thing in this situation. Anytime we don't understand something, whether it's, you know, something in the cosmos or something in our sky, it's always worthwhile to investigate what it is. And I think that it's always good to have that opportunity to do so. So I think the dissemination of information is a great thing. Whether or not it will pan out that it's actually an extraterrestrial life is a different question, but I certainly think it's a worthwhile endeavor to look at. Of course, and I'm probably not the first one to say this at all, is that if you don't know what something is in the sky, then it's by default an unidentified object, even if it doesn't mean it's an extraterrestrial life.
All right, so let's move on, because I want to make sure we get into this topic as well. I was surprised to find this on your class syllabus for an astronomer about free will. Can you tell me why this would be in the astronomy-based course?
So we talk about free will and consciousness, mostly because we want to have these conversations about what is life. And I think that requires a discussion of consciousness to a certain extent. I am not a classically trained philosopher, and so these are always very interesting discussions that we have in my class, because it's coming from the side of an astronomer. And I had to learn a lot to have these discussions. But the idea behind free will is, you know, it's something fundamental that I think most people would say, like, I have this, I have free will. But when you look at the laws of physics, or what physics tells us, once again, going back to quantum mechanics, that says that there's this perhaps innate randomness or probability, maybe not randomness, but probability to our life or to the nature of the universe, that starts to call into question, do I really have free will if everything is just kind of these jiggling particles that are dictated by some probability? That maybe makes some people worried. And then the next level of that is, if you take multiverse theory at face value, which says, one version of it says that anything that can happen will happen. It's just maybe not in your version of the universe. But if you have an infinite number of copies of a universe, you can play out every event, however it would happen. That's kind of the weirdness of multiverse theory, and what you have to accept if you take it at face value. But when you lay out the idea of multiverse theory as everything that can happen will happen, that kind of strips you of your free will, because you're not deciding to do something. It's just the version of you that you're aware of did this thing, but the other version of you in a different universe that you can't access and can't talk to, they did something else. And did you really make that decision, or are you just the product of everything that happens will happen? And that's why we talk about free will in this class, because some people are really quick to, multiverse theory is fun to talk about and absolutely like a valid thing people are investigating. I don't mean to downplay it in any way. But that's a consequence of multiverse theory. And so I get students who are gung-ho about multiverse theory, and then I lay that on them that, okay, multiverse theory is a go, so you don't have free will anymore. And that's not necessarily true or has to be the consequence, but it is certainly something you have to think about in the context of multiverse theory. And so that's why it shows up. We talk about free will, and it always kind of freaks out my students. So it's exciting.
Well, if I didn't have free will, then would I need to do the homework, and wouldn't you just choose what kind of grade to give me?
That is the problem with that whole conversation at some point.
So let's talk about free will. We have a little less than 5 minutes left, Alice and Costa. So would you think that if there is some form of, I think it's called determinism, where things are determined for you, if there is some form of determinism, is free will for the smaller decisions, but you have no impact on the predetermined end result aspects? Or are things saying that it's all up to you, or it doesn't really matter?
Yeah, so as you've laid out, you have these two choices. You can say everything is predetermined or everything is indeterminate. And I think, I mean, I don't do this professionally. I just like to think and muse and have these discussions with people who are willing to dive into it. But I think that we don't have to choose one or the other. I think maybe that there's a middle ground that we actually live in. And one of the reasons I think that is because, though I've been talking about quantum mechanics and this kind of probability jitter, this randomness that might seep into the laws of physics, you and I do not experience that for the most part, because we are like too big, essentially, for quantum mechanics to play a significant role in our day-to-day lives. We can essentially ignore it, and we do. They don't teach quantum mechanics at K-12 schools. I think there's an interesting argument being made that maybe we should, maybe like a qualitative version of it. But we don't teach it because mostly it doesn't affect our day-to-day life, and it's because we're too big. So if you take that statement, I think that might play a role in this decision of which extreme do we need? Is everything predetermined, or do we just have this probability messing everything up, this chaos, essentially. And I think that there's some middle ground to those statements.
It just makes me think of the Truman Show. Jim Carrey lives in this bubble that he doesn't know is a movie set or a TV show set, actually. And so everyone around him is an actor responding to what he does, but they're all playing set roles and a script. And he's the only one sort of doing his own thing until later on in life when he suddenly discovers this isn't real. Regardless, Allison Costa here today with us as we talk about unsolved mysteries in the universe. Just about a minute and a half left with Allison. So, Allison, we talked about the fact that you are at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. That's a fairly new job. What are you going to be doing there?
I'm helping with observatory roles now. I just started this. So I'm still kind of learning the ropes of the place and getting my feet under me there, transitioning away from teaching at UVA and doing astronomy research. So transitioning to more of a support role at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory.
Will you be teaching your class again in the upcoming semester?
Not this coming year, but I do hope to have the opportunity to teach perhaps in later semesters. It's certainly a door I want to keep open because I really enjoy teaching and developing course materials and just kind of having the opportunity to interact with people who haven't thought about this stuff before.
Again, our guest today, Allison Costa, National Radio Astronomy Observatory, and a visiting scholar at UVA's Department of Astronomy. Allison, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right. Take care, everyone. See you next Sunday.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.